graves in a flooded cemetery. "Rivers aren't supposed to have tides," said Gondorf. Centuries of Egyptian pharaohs, nomadic Baggara tribesmen, and Nile Basin farmers were familiar with the Amantharan floods. Not Gondorf, however. Between July and October, the Nile would swell from snowmelt in the Ethiopian mountains. In June, the river would subside, leaving dark, fertile mud, Kemet in Arabic, behind. Gondorf had dumped the crates months ago at high water. Now he had a 50-foot mud bank with missile crates sticking out of the muck 100 yards from his office window. Gable looked at the narrow, pinched face, the close-set, gerboa eyes, and the pinched mouth that was full of "It's not my fault" right behind his teeth. "There are militia patrols everywhere, boats on the river, scavengers on the riverbanks," said Gondorf. "How long have those cases been out there?" said Gable. "Why don't you get your gomers to retrieve them?" "I can't. They're out of contact," said Gondorf. "What are you talking about? You can't contact your assets? I can't find them. They don't respond." "Jesus wept," said Gable, flipping the binoculars to Gondorf. He walked down the hall to the Malat's office and introduced himself to Colonel Bianchi, who was tall, dark, ramrod straight, with hair combed straight back and shiny with brilliantine. He was in civvies, a light suit with a blue shirt and plain black tie. He wore a Marine Corps pin on his lapel. Gable sat down and explained the problem. Bianchi shook his head. "I've known a lot of you spooks over the years," he said with Mississippi in his mouth, "but that boy of yours is as sharp as a sack of wet mice." "Yeah," said Gable. "He's a real asshat. Colonel, those cases have been immersed for 3 to 4 months, and now they're covered in mud. Any chance those stingers will be functional?" "Those cases are water-resistant but not waterproof," said Bianchi. "If some of the gaskets on those cases held up, you probably got a handful that would light up and fly. But nothing reliable." He shook his head. "But that's not a worry. The militia finds those stingers, there'll be more political trouble than we can handle." "Militia any good?" asked Gable. "They ride around town 4 to a jeep with AKs looking for trouble. Not much training, but pretty mean." "You got anyone who could help me get those cases out tonight?" said Gable. Bianchi shook his head. "My office is down to 2. My deputy's on home leave, and the ambassador wouldn't approve of using the Marines. Something happens out there, we lose our embassy watchstanders." He watched Gable's reaction before he spoke again. "We might be in luck. 2 SEALs with Team 8 working with AFRICOM are here doing embassy evacuation surveys. They might be willing to help." He picked up a phone, and in 2 minutes, the SEALs knocked on the door. They were both in their 20s, lean and quiet. They wore jeans and flip-flops. Senior Chief Petty Officer Gilbert Gil Lox was blonde and freckled. He was a breacher, a demolitions expert who could open a can of peaches with a few grains of RDX without spilling the syrup. Petty Officer First Class Richard Ricky Ruvo was Italian, swarthy with Staten Island wise guy eyes. He was a sniper who could drive a nail into a tree at 1,500 yards. They sat slumped in chairs, arms crossed over their stomachs, looking at Gable like sleepy leopards on a tree limb. "I need some backup. I figure we get a truck with a winch and drag those cases out of the mud," said Gable. He turned to Bianchi. "What we got for weapons?" "Not much," said Bianchi. "Glocks and 9mm, Remington 870s. We have rifled slug hand buck." Gable nodded. "Glad to help," said Ruvo. "I'll stand over watch while you guys get the cases." "Bullshit," said Lox. "I outrank you. You get in the mud." "Gil, you can't hit shit," said Ruvo. "I always shoot first and call whatever I hit the target," said Gable. The SEALs nodded. An unspoken code had been transmitted and received. Gable was okay. "You CIA guys still recruiting frogmen?" asked Lox, whose time in the teams was running short. "Yeah. We got a whole division that teaches squids how to use a knife and fork," said Gable. "But it's filling up fast." Ruvo, Lox, and Bianchi all laughed. It was pitch black when Gable drove the F-350 truck in second gear across the dusty field with lights doused and put the nose of the truck into the break of the riverbank scrub. There was a dilapidated fisherman's shed made of irregular sheets of corrugated tin at the river's edge. Lox peeked through a gap in the metal and shook his head. Empty. Ruvo shoved 5 Sabot shells into the 870, jacked the slide, and clambered up onto the roof of the cab. He did a 360 turn and whispered okay. Gable and Locks put their pistols into their belt holsters at the smalls of their backs. Silently cursing Gondorf, Gable went knee-deep into the mud, pulling the wire rope off the spool, while Locks stood beside the winch, holding the remote controller. A tactical flashlight between his teeth, Gable waded to the nearest case, put the snap hook onto one of the metal handles, and waved to Locks. The truck swayed a little, but the 9,500-pound pull of the winch broke the suction, and the case slithered up the bank. One down, 11 to go. An hour later, there were 3 more cases left, but Locks had to get in up to his thighs to help Gable dig away mud so they could clip onto a handle. The two of them were on either side of a partially buried case, flashlights in their mouths. Locke's back was to the Black River. Then it happened. A warning shout from Ruvo came seconds before a 14-foot Nile crocodile erupted out of the water behind Locke's in an explosion of spray, jaws open. Unable to move in the mud, Locke's could only throw himself across the top of the muddy case. Gable never moved faster in his life. He drew his pistol and pumped all 17 9mm rounds into the croc's cotton-white mouth, but it only shook its head and slammed its jaws down on Locke's buttocks. Perhaps distracted by Gable's light, the croc miraculously did not bite down on flesh, but rather hooked an eye tooth on Locke's hip holster, tore his cargo pants down to the ankles, shook its head, spit out the gun, and turned to bite again. Ruvo's shotgun barked from the bank. A 2-inch spot between the croc's eyes spouted blood, and the croc collapsed in the mud, its tail whipping twice, its walnut-sized brain vaporized. The sounds of the shots echoed over the river and across the fields. A dog began barking. Gable looked at Locks, who gave a thumbs up. They both looked at the black water, specifically at 2 more gray shapes moving toward them. "Fuck this," said Gable, who quickly threaded the snap hook through the handles on the first, then the second, then the third case, and gave Ruvo the sign. The winch groaned, the handles bent, the cases groaned and popped, but all 3 broke free and slid up the bank. Gable and Locks pulled each other onto dry land, the grunts of crocs in the river behind them. Locks was pantless and muddy to his chest.
"First time I ever saw a croc give someone a wedgie," said Ruvo.
"Thanks for getting that fucker off me," said Locks. "Slug went right by my left ear."
Ruvo had snapped the 20-yard head tap with a shotgun's iron sights and low light from the upper bank, a remarkable shot.
"I was going to wait to see how big a croc's dick was. You bent over like that," said Ruvo.
Locks flipped in the bird. They finished loading the filthy cases onto the truck when the sound of an approaching Jeep came out of the night, its headlight beam bouncing as the Jeep jounced over the dried furrows in the field. Militia.
"Heads up, ladies," said Gable out of the side of his mouth. He seated a new magazine into his Glock.
"None of these fuckers goes home," said Ruvo, holding his shotgun slightly behind his leg.
The Jeep pulled close, its engine windmilling until it fell silent. The 4 men in the Jeep wore a collection of watch caps, kepis, and berets. The American stood in the light of the single working headlamp. The driver stood up in his seat and said, "Kaifa halak." His tattered, sweat-stained shirt was unbuttoned. The passenger also stood up in his seat to look at the men over the filthy, cracked windshield. No weapons were visible. The driver again yelled, "Kaifa halak," to raucous laughter. The passenger pointed to Locke's bare legs, said something, and spit on the ground to additional laughter.
"That guy likes your package, Gil," said Ruvo.
"These fuckers are all loopy, chewing cod all day," whispered Gable.
The driver reached down beneath the dashboard and tugged on the barrel of an AK-47.
"Weapon," barked Ruvo, who brought up the shotgun, shot through the windshield, and blew the driver off the Jeep in a cloud of pulverized glass.
Gable shot the passenger in 1.5 seconds with a double tap in the chest and a 3rd round in the head, a triple called the Mozambique. The guy collapsed and slid beneath the dashboard. Even before he hit the floor, Ruvo and Locks advanced on the vehicle in the bent shuffle of close-quarter combat, each firing 3 rounds, simultaneously knocking the 2 in the back seat over the rear of the Jeep. The sounds of the shots rocketed into the night air,
and more dogs on both sides of the river started barking. Aspirated grunts came from the Black River. The dead passenger in the jeep settled sideways. The whole evolution had lasted 12 seconds.
"You CIA guys all this good?" said Locks.
He had last seen the Mozambique used in Panama.
"Yeah, it's the sensitivity training we get," said Gable, "and the pistol instructors from Texas."
The SEALs looked sideways at Gable.
"You could do with more time on the range," said Ruvo to Locks. "You hit that last guy a little high."
"Didn't hear him complain," said Locks.
"Let's get the fuck out of here," said Gable. "Check these guys for IDs, usually little paper booklets."
"I'll ditch the jeep behind the shed," said Locks. "You want me to rig a bang on the ignition?"
Gable shook his head. "Odds are some kids will find it first. Let them have it."
"What about these guys?" asked Ruvo, looking at the tangle of legs on the ground.
"Wait a minute," said Locks. "Listen."
The sound of multiple vehicles coming across the field and the babbling of excited voices were faint but getting louder.
"Fuck," said Gable, peeking around the tangle of riverine brush. "More militia. I make three jeeps and a click out coming slowly."
Ruvo racked the shotgun slide.
"That makes no more than 12 loopy lovers. We each take out a jeep and we're done."
Gable shook his head.
"They heard our shots. They'll come in expecting trouble. Odds are too great something happens and we lose the missiles."
Locke slapped a muddy missile case on the truck bed.
"Let's fucking use three of these puppies to take out the three jeeps."
"We sure they're gonna light up?" said Ruvo.
"They've been immersed for a long time."
Gable looked through the brush again.
"They're slowing down, running close to the bank. They don't know what they're looking for. You guys take the truck back across the field to the embassy. Bianchi's waiting at the gate and he'll open the storeroom. Get those missiles locked down and safe."
"What the fuck you think you're gonna do?" said Ruvo.
"I'll knock out a couple headlights, crawl into the brush, and keep them pinned down. They won't notice you guys in the truck crossing the field."
"There's 12 of those gomers," said Locks.
"I'll stay and Ruvo can get those cases back."
Gable shook his head.
"You both get those cases back to the embassy. One drive, one riding shotgun, don't stop for anything."
The SEALs were pros and didn't argue. Ruvo kept his pistol but handed Gable the shotgun and a pocket full of shells.
Locks handed over his Browning pistol and two spare magazines.
Gable stuck the pistol in his belt and stuffed his pockets with ammo.
"We'll get back with more firepower ASAP," said Locks. "Just keep their heads down and stay in the damn brush. Don't be a hero."
Gable shook their hands. "Thanks for giving me a hand tonight. You guys made the world secure for another week at least."
Locks pointed at Ruvo. "I'm still turning this asshole into the World Wildlife Federation for killing an endangered species of riverine reptile," he said.
"If this asshole hadn't got that croc off you, you wouldn't have an asshole," said Ruvo.
The sounds of the rattle-trap jeeps were coming closer, the beams of the headlights waving in the air as the tires bounced over the dried furrows in the field.
"Back around these weeds and don't go until I start popping at these gomers. Then steer for the yellow lamp on the corner of the embassy. Get those cases under lock and key."
The SEALs climbed into the truck, backed it up, and sat waiting. Ruvo gave Gable a thumbs up. Gable stood behind a little corrugated hut, peeking around the corner at the approaching headlights. They had spread out from a file into a line abreast as the field had widened, yelling across to one another, not paying attention. But they all held their rifles in their hands.
"This is going to be tricky," thought Gable.
The jeeps slowed and stopped 8 meters from the hut, about 25 feet, a long pistol shot, but these troops all had rusty AK-47s and the rounds would go through the tin walls of the hut like a hot knife through butter. Gable figured he'd shoot from the direction of the hut, then scurry into the brush and let the gomers have fun demolishing the hut while he dug into the weeds, which would give the SEALs time to get to the embassy back gate. Gable saw the militiaman farthest to the right stand and point at the field. He'd spotted the truck's hood sticking out from the brush. In the next second, they would swarm in that direction and engage the truck. Just what he couldn't let happen. Gable stepped from behind the shack into the glare of 6 headlights, racking the pump so fast the shots sounded simultaneous, and fired 3 loads of buckshot into the right jeep whose windshield disintegrated. The 2 men in the front seat fell out onto the ground dead. The 2 in the back seat, 1 wailing and wounded, bailed out and hid behind their vehicle. Before the dead man had hit the ground, Gable pivoted to put three more rounds into the middle Jeep, killing the driver, while the other three jumped out and hid under the Jeep. He aimed his last two shots at the far Jeep, knocking a rear passenger backward out of his seat. By Gable's count, four were down and maybe one or more wounded. At least seven left and maybe eight. Militiamen were hiding under the respective vehicles, all of them screaming at one another in what sounded to Gable as, "Ahmed, get up and start shooting," and more jabbering that sounded like, "Are you crazy? You get up and start shooting." Gable jacked four of the dark green shells into the Remington, his last shells, and these were the rifled slugs, tapered solid lead projectiles as big as marbles, the equivalent of a 50 caliber bullet, and one by one put a slug into the radiator of each Jeep, causing a great whooshing explosion of steam and cascade of water under each vehicle. Those Jeeps weren't going anywhere now, and the SEALs were home free. Out of the corner of his eye, Gable saw movement along the back wall of the shack. The metal flexed as someone slid along it inside the hut. Gable shot the last slug at the bulging metal, knocking a back wall panel out and blowing the militiaman through a front wall panel. Shotgun empty, two 15-round pistols left with two spare mags, and maybe 17 militiamen left with AKs. Shit odds. More movement in the bulrushes by the river, where were the Crocs when you needed them, and rifle fire started up from the reeds, too close, and Gable dove into the shed, temporary concealment but certainly not cover, and slow-crawled behind some broken wooden crates that stunk like fish, and hunkered down as a militiaman stuck his head into the hole in the wall, and Gable shot him in the head. But two other gomers were coming through the door shooting from the hip, and Gable dropped one of them with a snap shot in the face, and felt a punch in his right shoulder. No pain, just numb down to his hand. So he shot the second gomer with his left hand twice in the chest, feeling another round hit his thigh. This one hurt like a son-of-a-bitch hot knitting needle, and rounds started coming through the flimsy metal, each hole creating a glancing shaft of light from the Jeep headlights. Gable wiggled into a corner, putting in a fresh mag one-handed by holding the pistol between his knees with the magazine well pointing up, emergency reload, and he released the slide and started firing at the two gomers coming through the door, but felt two more slugs hit him in the chest, and rounds were still coming through the metal. But Gable was feeling numb, and it was like he was breathing through a straw, not enough breath. And he saw Nash in Athens Station, and Dominica in a summer dress, and Moira playing piano barefoot, his only regret, how he screwed up his marriage, and how she died before he had a chance to patch it up. He remembered the happy first month, the honeymoon on Cudjo Key, and he could smell the salt air. The two surviving militiamen were leaning against the fender of their hissing Jeep, shakily lighting cigarettes when both their heads exploded and they dropped like string-cut puppets, the cigarettes still in their mouths. Ruvo and Lox came out of the darkness and looked at the dead soldiers around the shattered Jeeps, then looked inside the shack. Five militiamen lay piled in front of Gable, who was sitting up against the wall, eyes closed, his shirt front black with blood. Ruvo checked his pulse. "He's gone," he said. "God damn it." They were quiet for a second, fellow gladiators mourning one of their own. "Let's get him back," said Lox. "Seals never leave their fallen behind." "We got a little work to do first," said Ruvo. The next morning, with Colonel Bianchi sitting in a chair in front of his desk, Gondorf reported by secure phone to Benford, who, after a stunned silence on hearing that Gable was dead, cursed for 5 minutes and told him to stay by the phone. He secretly vowed to drum him out of the service. Gondorf blanched when Bianchi told him about the firefight with the militia patrols, but he did not appear to be concerned any longer about the missiles, now that they were securely returned to the embassy storeroom. And he seemed not to care that a CIA officer was in a plastic bag, lying on a pallet in the embassy cooler. He saw a way to divert blame as he reverted to the gas bag bureaucrat careerist his colleagues knew him to be. "Your guys killed 12 militia troops, are you crazy? There will be serious repercussions when they're found." Gondorf was thinking about official protests, riots at the embassy front gate, a fuming ambassador, diplomatic expulsions. "More like 14. Your guy got 8 himself. No one's gonna find anything," said Bianchi. They parked the Jeeps down the road behind a warehouse with the keys in them. You're all maniacs. When they find the men, all hell will break loose.
Those guys ain't coming home for supper. Here.
Bianchi flipped a pile of militiamen's ID booklets on Gondorf's desk. They were soggy with sweat and blood, one with a bullet hole through the center. Gondorf's mouth curled with disgust as he flipped open one booklet with the point of a pencil.
Jesus, Gondorf said. That's one of my support assets who got rid of the missiles in the first place.
Any more? Said Bianchi. Gondorf opened the other booklets with the pencil. His face fell.
This one too, and this one, three of them. I don't know the others.
Pretty efficient agent network you got going there, Mr. Chief of Station, recruiting Khartoum militia as clandestine assets, said Bianchi.
Who your SEALs gunned down last night like some gangsters.
Your so-called assets were coming last night to retrieve those missiles, you dickhead, said Bianchi. Your man Gable got zapped to save your ass, which I'd personally like to kick.
What about the missiles, said Gondorf, ignoring the threat. I want them out of here.
You want them out, said Bianchi. I called up a Seahawk 60 from the Nimitz in the Red Sea. The Navy will fly them out, and Gable too.
Gondorf looked at the Milat, trying to decide how to strengthen his position, for there was always some bureaucratic dodge, some refuge. His thoughts raced to creating a distracting controversy with DOD as scapegoat. He pointed at Bianchi accusingly.
Your office is going to have to answer for murdering those men. I'm filing an official crimes report to DOJ.
Based on what? Said Bianchi, getting out of his chair.
The SEALs flew out for Little Creek last night. All flights departed Khartoum after midnight when the soft, sun-baked tar runways hardened and the cooler night air.
The Pentagon isn't going to help you. The way you act on the country team, and the ambassador is pissed at your scary good performance, my guess is that whoever that was from Langley screaming over the phone will make you feel like you were swallowed by wolves and shit over a cliff.
Bianchi walked to the office door.
You're forgetting one thing, said Gondorf, sweating. When they find those men, there's going to be a shitstorm with you right in the middle of it.
Bianchi looked out at the river through the blinds.
The SEALs took care of it. Like I told you, those militia troopers won't be home for supper, said Bianchi over his shoulder. River Crocs already had them over for dinner last night. Chevalier soup, sorrel soup. Sauté greens, traditionally wild sorrel, or substitute dandelion, watercress, or spinach, with chopped onions until wilted and soft. Add chicken stock, bring to a boil, then simmer to finish. Remove from heat, add sugar and lemon juice for balance. Temper egg yolks with broth, stir into soup, and simmer without boiling. Serve hot or cold with sour cream.
Chapter 21. Smell a Rat.
Benford woke Nate up in the middle of the night with the black news about Gable. Nate felt the icy shock run up his back, and he stood gripping the receiver. Gable, indestructible, a shootout in Khartoum for nothing. That piece of crap, Gondorf. Nate asked about services, the funeral, memorials.
Never mind that, Benford said. You get to the safe house tomorrow and do your job.
How do I tell her? Nate said. He was like a brother. You do not, under any circumstances, tell her. She cannot fall apart, not now. Keep her focused. She's got to lead us to Magnet. We have to wrap up that illegal in New York, and she's got to make sure Shlikov is thrown in prison.
Pretty long to-do list, Simon. You forgot Barry Marty Gable.
Nate braced for the explosion, not really caring. Surprisingly, Benford's voice was muted.
You know perhaps better than most what he would have told you right now.
He would have told you to do your job, protect your asset, get the intel, and set up the next contact. I would add that you should make him as proud of you as he always was.
Nate swallowed hard.
I'll send the cable when we're finished, said Nate.
Istanbul's safe house, Amaranth, stood behind a massive wooden gate with iron studs topped by medieval spikes. The gravel drive wound slightly downhill toward the water. The ornate villa, Yala in Turkish with its sloping red tile roof, stood alone amid pine trees right at the edge of the Bosphorus,
its lower foundation continually wetted by the gentle wakes from passing Black Sea freighters. The interior of the Yala was magnificent, full of elaborate moldings and painted ceilings and walls decorated in endless geometric Islamic patterns in gold and turquoise. A broad central salon was graced by a bubbling marble fountain. The salon was flanked by corner sitting rooms that overhung the Bosphorus, cooled by breezes through panoramic gallery windows. The corner rooms were furnished in high Ottoman style, with low sofas and massive copper tray chargers on carved wooden legs. Up the curved staircase of pink marble on the second floor, four broad bedrooms featured canopy beds in peacock blue. Each bedroom led to a matching bath. Nate drove to the safe house via a circuitous SDR over the Fatih Sultan Mehmet Bridge into Asia, where he strung together a series of stair-step turns and loops in the hilly neighborhoods of Üsküdar, Umranye, Gubuley, and Zerzavatchi. During the one loop in the scrubland, he stopped at a turnoff and used the surrounding gnarly hills as a sound-catching bowl to listen for the purr of fixed or rotary-wing aircraft, a denied area trick Gable had taught him. Nothing. These were poor districts with muddy lanes and rusted satellite dishes, ruined trucks balanced on cinder blocks, and mountains of discarded tires visible behind corrugated metal walls strung with barbed wire. This Asian Istanbul was nothing like the glamorous enclaves of the coast road on the European side. He was black, no surveillance team, not even those TNP pros, could stay undetected so completely and still know where he was. He had rented the little Hyundai that morning from the lobby of the Mövenpick Hotel in Maslak, so he was not sweating vehicle beacons. He knew Diva would be as thorough, running a tight route before she got on the ferry. Given the splash she'd made by bagging Shlikov, a too-long absence from the resident tour would be risky. Nate was not sure they'd have even 5 hours for debriefings. Nate's final SDR leg, memorized by studying maps like an actor memorizes lines, was along Machartabia Chadasi, working his mirrors and catching glimpses of the water between the trees. He drove through the gate, closed it behind him, and coasted down the gravel drive to the house. Its three stories with ornate roofline was painted pink with white gingerbread trim, incongruous in the piney woods. Nate quickly surveyed the opulent interior. Triple doors on the ground floor salon led outside to the breezy veranda, with the Bosphorus glittering in the morning sun. There was a narrow strip of grass between the house and the pier. White wrought iron lanterns were spaced along the breakwater wall. Some pasha must have had glittering soirees in this house, thought Nate. Time check, 0900 hours. She'd be here in 3 hours. He sat on a low couch in the Ottoman-style living room and reviewed his notes. He had rehearsed what he would say to Dominica, but he didn't know if he could avoid telling her about Gable despite Benford's orders. Would she still be furious at him? Now she was inside the Kremlin, enveloped by the approving embrace of President Vladimir Vladimirovich. She probably would become director of SVR and would be generating staggering intelligence for Langley. Her latest reporting had averted an apocalyptic terror campaign in this city. Nate was sitting in the relative dark of the room, doors open, the long gauzy shears floating in the wind. He peripherally registered movement on the lawn. It was Dominica holding a small case in her hand. She had somehow gotten through the gate or over the wall and come around the side of the house, 2 hours early. Nate did not move, watching her through the French doors. She faced the water, dropped her bag, shook out her hair in the breeze, and looked at a freighter thrumming down the channel. She lifted one foot, then the other, slipping sandals off her feet. Her dark blue summer dress billowed in the breeze, right out of Wuthering Heights. Nate walked to the open door and leaned against the frame. "I'm sorry, but the property is not for sale," he said. Dominica did not turn, but continued to look at the water. "Are you the owner?" said Dominica over her shoulder. "I represent the owners," said Nate, stepping down to the grass and walking up behind her. "Are you sure they will not consider selling?" she said. She turned around and brushed wind-blown hair off her face. She took a step toward him. They were inches apart. "How much are you willing to offer?" said Nate. "For a view like this, price is no object," said Dominica. She put her arms around his neck and buried her face in his shoulder. Nate lightly held her waist. They stood like that for a long minute, then Dominica stepped back and wiped her wet cheek.
Как ты?
She whispered in Russian. How are you?
Привет,
said Nate.
Hi.
I missed you. Business now.
How did you get here early? How long do we have today? I've got a lot of questions.
I took a different ferry than a bus, then I walked. It was a lovely morning.
When are you expected back? Said Nate.
I told them I was conducting a security survey. No one would question me.
How long? Said Nate, who could feel his scalp.
Tomorrow night, said Dominica. I return to Moscow the next morning.
You can be out of pocket that long, are you sure?
Dominica nodded.
And where is Bratok? She said.
He rarely missed a meeting with her.
He's away on a trip, said Nate without inflection. They had 2 days together, alone. Nate looked at her, the high cheekbones, the straight nose, the smooth forehead. There were new faint lines around those blue eyes that flitted over her face, reading the corners of his mouth, looking for clues about them. The bubble popped when Nate said they should go inside and get to work. Dominica smiled, reached for his hand, and walked barefoot with him into the house. His halo had flickered when he mentioned Gable, but she ignored it. Dominica was on the parquet floor, sitting cross-legged on a plush, rust-red kilim pillow. Nate was on the couch, which was covered by sheets of yellow legal pages from the last 3 hours of debriefing. Nate had also recorded the entire session on his Talon note-taking tablet. It was common practice to both record and take notes. The former would be a precise record of Dominica's words and intelligence reports, the latter is a more convenient summary from which to draft cables to headquarters. A spiral map book of Moscow lay open on the floor. It had been annotated by Dominica to designate possible new dead drop and shrack sites if she ever received replacement shrack gear. They reviewed exfiltration pickup sites, the ones Moscow case officer Ricky Walters had described. Dominica sniffed that the exfil sites should be saved for those hysterical assets who would agree to defect in time of crisis.
Domi, stop being dramatic, said Nate. We have to be prepared to get you out if something happens. But he said it half-heartedly. Usually they argued about defection passionately. She noticed it. After 3 hours, they both were tired. Dominica had filled in a lot of detail from her abbreviated previous reports, dead dropped in Moscow. No shrack gear replacement was on the horizon, and there were still no hints regarding magnet.
There is one more important item, said Dominica. Please make sure Benford is aware of this.
Nate nodded.
The SVR has established contact with the Chinese intelligence service.
The MSS? Said Nate. Russia and China? This could be big, he thought.
At the orders of the president, said Dominica. But something is not right. We do not trust them, and they do not trust us.
Then what is the point of opening relations? Said Nate.
We are exploring possible areas of mutual interest, said Dominica. But I think my exalted president wants something bigger. Tell Gospodin Benford that it is my guess that Putin will do what he can to worsen relations between China and the United States.
It is only my guess, but tell Benford that. An agent's opinion, a source comment, was valuable.
Domi, this is important. Can you get more details as it develops? Said Nate.
Of course. The Kremlin, Putin, has already designated 9KR as the lead office to meet with Chinese representatives. He wants me to report directly to him. I have not received specific operational directions, but the MSS are deceitful.
Podozrivat, I smell a mouse.
You smell a rat, he said. Dominica shrugged. She had stretched out her slim legs and was touching her toes to work out the kinks. When you know more, let us know, but go softly, be careful, said Nate.
Thank you for the tradecraft lesson, she said, nonchalantly trying not to smile. I am to meet the Chinese general in Moscow when I return.
Nate made more notes, but she knew something was wrong. Nate's halo was faded and waning.
Is something bothering you? She asked.
Nate buried his head in his tablet.
What?
He said.
You are acting strangely. She wondered if she would ever tell him about the colors. She decided to try to distract him. You should try stretching, to relax, like we did in ballet.
Demurely holding her dress down, she extended each leg out to the side in a perfect split, toes pointed, then leaned forward to touch her chin to the floor.
In yoga, it's called Upavista Konasana, she said. In Sparrow School, the divining rod.
What do you call it in CIA? Her chin still on the floor, she looked at Nate and blinked once. Irresistible sparrow instincts, thought Nate, looking at the femoral and adductor muscles of her thighs flex. The familiar passion was there. He couldn't feel his tongue, and there was a numb spot on the point of his chin. But Gable's face kept intruding. Now his resolve to stay professional for her sake as well as his was also for the memory of Gable. She straightened, brought her legs up and hugged her knees, and blinked at him again. Domenica saw the pulsing purple halo around his head and shoulders and was worried that he had changed, that he was tired of her intransigence, or that his disciplinary troubles finally had oxidized his love for her. She had not changed her view that despite the senior CIA men's protestations, their love affair was acceptable, something that sustained her, a justifiable departure from the rules of tradecraft and agent handling.
Bosh, God, she wanted him. The expectation of being with him had grown when she had boosted herself over the wall of the villa this morning. The sparrow tagline number 99, a whistling samovar never boils over, came to mind. But the decorous Russian in her would not be so nekulturni, so base as to stand up in front of him now, shrug the spaghetti straps off her shoulders and step out of her dress. She would not push him back on the couch with her hands on his chest and trail her breasts across his face. No, she wouldn't. They looked at each other shakily through the midday light. The ship's deep bass horn sounded in the channel as if signaling the end of round one. Nate gathered all his notes and stuffed them into his duffel. They went into the kitchen to find something for lunch. The modern kitchen was reasonably stocked by the safe housekeeper. Nate examined the refrigerator and carried an armful of ingredients to the big central table. Domenica boosted herself onto the counter and watched him while swinging her legs. He diced onions, crushed garlic, sliced a few mushrooms, cubed two tomatoes, and cut two chicken breasts into bite-sized pieces. He sautéed everything with oregano and a glass of cavacledre white, then covered the stew with grated kasar cheese and a spoonful of esme, spicy Turkish tomato sauce, from a jar in the fridge. He then put the sauté pan in the oven to melt the cheese to golden brown. It is like our chicken Orlov, said Domenica, sniffing the air. But we do not have this southern fascination for garlic.
Of course you don't, said Nate. I remember the Moscow subway in the summer, underarms, vodka, and cigarettes. You couldn't smell garlic if you tried.
Quite amusing, said Domenica, but she knew he was right.
There's only one rule about garlic, said Nate. Everyone at the table has to eat it. He walked around the table and stepped up to the counter between her dangling legs. He put his hands on her shoulders and, without artifice, pecked her on the mouth. Tonight I'll make Chinese stir-fry without garlic. I saw bell peppers in there. He went to the oven to check the pan, not quite ready. The brotherly kiss had her lips tingling. Was he teasing her, spinning her up? She watched him assessing the purple around his head and shoulders. Was he trying to act professionally and not make the first gesture? Was he testing her? She caught herself swinging her legs faster in agitation. Do not be nekulturni, she told herself. Using a kitchen towel to grasp the handle, Nate took the pan out of the oven and put it on a hot pad on the table. He laid out two bowls, silverware, and napkins. Domenica looked at him after the first bowl and nodded. It is very good, she said. You cannot taste the garlic. Without thinking, she reached for the still oven-hot handle of the pan to spoon some more into her bowl and whipped her hand off with a cry of pain, holding it against her chest. Nate took her hand, there was a crimson burn on her fingertips, and held them against his earlobe. She looked at him in amazement. The earlobes are filled with blood which draws the heat, like a diffuser, he said.
Where did you learn this? Said Dominica. Who are you?
Nate smiled and kept her hand against his ear.
It feels better, said Dominica. But it still hurts. I burned my palm, too.
Nate led her to the sink and ran cool water over her hand, then switched to warm after a minute to encourage circulation, he explained. He held her hand under the water, their faces inches apart, shoulders and hips touching. A single tear ran down her cheek, and her bottom lip quivered. Their eyes met, and Nate's hand closed gently over hers.
I'll always protect you, he whispered.
Dominica put her good arm around his neck, pulling his head closer, his purple aura enveloping her.
Dushka, dearest, she said, I will always love you.
She moved her mouth to his, but stopped an inch away, waiting. He brought his mouth onto hers. She held him tightly and sighed. A burned hand did it, the fractured levee of their resolve having collapsed under the floodwater of their passion. Dominica grasped Nate's wrist as if she feared he would escape and led him up the marble staircase to one of the peacock blue bedrooms. She stood stock still, her eyes closed, and felt him undress her. Dominica gently pushed Nate onto the bed and showed him number 47, ships passing in the night. Her breath was hot on his thigh as she finally quivered and whispered, "Da," and rolled off him, groaning. Nate lost count of how many times Dominica stuttered, "Da, da, da," that golden afternoon, her wild hair spread on the pillow, her breasts heaving, her arms hugging herself to stop the convulsions. They dozed but woke up hungry, and Dominica rummaged around in the massive armoire in the corner of the bedroom for something to wear and emerged wearing a fitted nightshirt, courtesy of Blanche Goldberg of Hollywood, that apparently had been fashioned out of a seine net. Nate said it was fine, everything was visible beneath the fine mesh, and they tiptoed downstairs in the dark, the shadowy salon lighted only indirectly by the automatic lanterns on the pier outside. The central fountain splashed quietly. They ate cold chicken stew in the dark, sharing a fork, and she wiped his mouth with her thumb and kissed him, and they drank out of the same wine glass and finished the bottle. Dominica looked at him with luminous eyes. In the living room, Nate found a cabinet with an old-fashioned turntable and a stack of LPs, and Dominica said, "That one?" Schubert piano waltzes, and Nate sat in the dark while Dominica stood in the moonlight, pinned her hair up, and pulled the shirt over her head. She was moon-bright naked, eyes closed, and motionless in profile. Something Minoan on an amphora, listening to the music, seeing the capering stepladders of colors in the air. She started dancing, slowly at first, then with strength, up on the balls of her feet, her calf muscles bunching, hands allongée and delicate, following the colors. He watched her ribcage expand, the scars crisscrossed silver in the moonlight, marking with an X the position of her heart. The cords of her neck stood out when she bent her neck. Distracted by her private ecstasies, Dominica did not notice that Nate's aura in the darkened living room was agitated and unsettled. It was typical of him that as he watched her glistening form, he began thinking of Gable. As he watched his music box ballerina twirl in the middle of the room, he told himself he had once again betrayed Gable's trust, only it was worse now that he was gone. Not even the latest intel and Diva's growing status in the Kremlin justified his debility. And there would be increased danger for Dominica. The initiative with the Chinese would have analysts buzzing for months, and they would have to exercise relentless source protection. CIA would soon begin receiving details about the SVR-MSS liaison that could only come from her, immensely dangerous. The initiative with the MSS had the familiar Soviet whiff of an unknown plot about to be hatched, like the undefinable smell of dead possum under the bed. And there was the matter of the mole and headquarters. If Magnet read a list of the premier Russian agents currently working in Moscow, Diva would be lost the minute Line S received the report. But there was something else. Soviet officials used to say that the beginning of one's ruin was the day one became Stalin's favorite. Putin was the same, more telegenic perhaps, wiser in matters of commerce and public relations, but with the same suspicions and implacable expectation that even trusted Confederates could not be trusted. And he had Stalin's capacity for violence. Dominica's neck would be in the noose every minute. All the exfil sites in the world wouldn't save her if she displeased her blue-eyed czar, or if she put a foot wrong, or if she fell afoul of one of the Siloviki. Dominica had stopped dancing and stood in the middle of the room, breathing hard, a rivulet of sweat between her breasts. The music ended, and now she did notice the oscillating colors in the corner. "Thy bog, bless the man," she thought, the inevitable fretting. She was not going to waste this night or the next morning in this beautiful villa with her net. Stark naked, she walked to him, knelt between his legs, and put her chin on his chest. "You are a fool," she said, looking into his eyes. Nate looked up at the domed ceiling sparkling with turquoise inlay. His purple halo swirled as if stirred by the sea breeze. "We should review everything once more," said Nate stupidly. He couldn't guarantee that Dominica would come out next month or 2 years from now or ever again. She read his mind. "Glupets," said Dominica. "Dunce. We have until tomorrow. Then I go home." "I want to go over the exfil routes again," said Nate, like a French tutor. "I know them all," said Dominica. "We should make sure of the pickup sites," he said. "We will not discuss exfiltration, not tonight," she said firmly. "Do you ever dream of an end to this?" said Nate. She raised her head to look at him. "Dushka, I am too close to think of that now. The president wants me on the project with the Chinese. I am meeting the Siloviki. They soon will tell me Magnet's identity. I can feel it. There are enormous possibilities." "Getting close to Putin is priceless," said Nate. "But it's mortally dangerous. He'll be watching your every move." "What is wrong with you?" Nate felt himself sliding down a slope. "Marty Gable always told me the most important thing was to keep you safe," Nate said. Dominica laughed. "To keep me safe and receive the intelligence, that's what he always said." "If he were here, he would tell you," Dominica said, nuzzling him. Nate's chest was numb, but he couldn't stop himself. "Marty Gable's dead. He died in Khartoum 2 days ago." Dominica's face fell. For a moment she searched his face, then her eyes filled up and tears ran silently down her face. She straightened and backed away from him. "What happened? Were Russians involved? You knew from the time we met. When were you going to tell me, after another hour in the bedroom? Or when I finished dancing naked for you in the parlor?" "I wasn't going to tell you at all. I didn't want to upset you, not now." "You think I could not continue, that my grief would overcome me?" "No. I knew I had to tell you. I didn't know how." Dominica stood up, still luminous in the moonlight, and began walking to the staircase. "What are you doing?" said Nate. Dominica turned. "I am going to bed and mourn for my Bratok. Then I will return to the embassy on the early ferry and fly back to Moscow tomorrow night." Her chest rose and fell with emotion. "I am willing to risk everything for my country, for Forsyth, Benford, and Bratok," she said, "for my parents and for Korchnoi, Ioana, and Udranka. And especially for us. I need only one thing to be able to continue. I need to know you love me." Nate got up and was going to take her in his arms, but she held up a hand to stop him. The salon was silent save for the tick-tick of the phonograph needle stuck at the end of the record. "We will say goodbye in the morning, and you can tell me then," Dominica said. "You know I love you," said Nate. Dominica turned and walked up the staircase, an alabaster vision passing through bars of moonlight. "I know," she said. "I just want to hear it one last time." The bass note foghorn of a passing ship in the Bosphorus Channel drifted through the gallery windows and filled the room up to the turquoise ceiling. Chicken saute with cheese, Kasharli Tavuk. Sauté onions, garlic, mushrooms, and tomatoes in olive oil, butter, and a splash of white wine. Add bite-sized pieces of chicken breast and simmer, covered until tender. Cover stew with kasar cheese, or substitute mozzarella, and top with Turkish ezme, or a spicy tomato sauce. Bake until cheese has melted and is golden brown. Serve with rice. Chapter 22. Elephantine Failure. They didn't even let her get through customs at Sheremetyevo Airport. A small man in a suit that didn't button straight stepped up to her in the arrivals line. A uniformed police officer stood behind him, heels together, watching Dominica's face. A nanosecond of icy dread, then normalcy. A little man bowed and said he was from protocol, and that a car was outside, code for "Come at once to the Kremlin, the President is waiting." On another day, the reception could easily be as cordial, until she was escorted into a reception room where young blonde men, a dozen Valery Shlikovs, would push her down onto a straight-backed chair, an arm around her neck, and undress her while holding her arms and legs so she couldn't swallow anything. And then take her to Butyrka prison. Another day. The familiar drumming of the Kremlin cobblestones filled the cloying, rosewater-scented Mercedes as it sped through the crenellated tower of the Borovitskaya Gate. How many times would she hear the tires moan over these stones, the harmonic preparation before Putin's next symphony? The car careered around the Ivan the Great bell tower and past the Tsarsky Kolokol, the 200-ton cracked Tsar's bell, never rung, never pealed, a metaphor for Putin's regime. They traversed Ivanovskaya Square, the paved maiden guarded by the Tsarsky Pushka, the Tsar's imperial cannon, an immense cast bronze bombard never fired in war, and through the narrow Senate building gate. In the circular courtyard, dark-suited attendants waited on the front steps. In another age, they would have been dressed in strawberry pink imperial livery with pinchbeck buttons and powdered wigs. Bathed in the pale yellow of sycophancy, the three aides, this many factotums was a notable indication of her status, led Dominica through the circular-domed Catherine Hall, its colonnade rich with gilt Corinthian capitals, along endless corridors with the reflected light of 100 crystal chandeliers, and down a final hallway with a frescoed vaulted ceiling alive with angels, cherubs, and seraphs. What must they have seen and heard since 1917? The private apartments of both Lenin and Stalin were on this third floor. They stopped at an inconspicuous and unadorned wooden alcove. An aide knocked softly once, opened the door, and minutely inclined his head toward Dominica. Putin's office was wood-paneled and narrow, an unprepossessing desk against the far wall. The president was standing behind the desk turning the pages of a file. He was wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, and red necktie. He looked up when Dominica came into the room and wordlessly gestured that she should sit at the small table in front of the desk. She sat with her hands in her lap. The simple travel dress she had worn on the plane was barely appropriate for the Kremlin, but Dominica resolved not to care. Gorelikov was not present, that was strange, and her spine tingled. Without speaking, he sat opposite her and rested his hands on the table. His blue aura, intelligence, guile, calculation, was strong and bright. Did he expect her to speak first? Did her performance as CI sleuth in Istanbul somehow raise suspicions? This is what Stalin used to do. Summon terrified subordinates and stare at them. At least it wasn't 3 a.m. in a superheated dacha. "What happened in Istanbul?" Putin said without preamble. "I met with my CIA handler, and besides dictating 14 intelligence reports on current compartmented SVR operations, alerted Langley to the Turkish Active Measures Initiative designed to neuter a Western ally and abet your unholy regime. My CIA handler and I also made love after I danced naked for him in the grand salon of a Bosphorus mansion," Dominica thought. "Major Shlikov is a galloping egotist, whom the Americans suborned with emoluments that have yet to be determined," said Dominica without inflection. "Line KR investigators will extract the truth soon." She held Putin's gaze. "Leave it," said Putin, waving a hand in the air. "Shlikov committed suicide in his cell last night." "Suicide? Not likely," He loved himself too much, thought Dominica. Sleep tight, you bastard. You were going to blow up children in Istanbul. She kept her face impassive, but felt the refrigerator chill of the president's eyes.
Unfortunate, said Dominica. There never was any doubt of his guilt.
There was no way Putin would advertise a covert action failure with a noisy public trial, she thought. Shlikov was doomed from the start. Dying secretly and unmourned in prison was a common fate of miscreants since the days of the Bolsheviks. I congratulate you again, Colonel. Your diligence and energy are exemplary, said Putin. You're becoming quite the mole catcher. Dominica willed herself to be still.
Spasibo, Mr. President.
Thank you, said Dominica, and kept quiet after that. She read this man closely, watched his colored aura. He did not value fawning, talkative sycophants. He looked for efficiency, discretion, and loyalty.
Once again the Americans intrude, said Putin. Istanbul was a debacle.
Dominica again suppressed laughter.
You have no idea, Zolotzi. Nugget, thought Diva. They wish to isolate Russia in the Mirovaya Zakulitsa, the world backstage, he said.
There it was, Putin's favorite domestic trope, the conspiracy of Western leaders against Russia, to stroke nationalism and distract attention from food shortages in the cities. Never mind that Putin's terror plot was defeated. Never mind that her dear president's estimated personal net worth from plundered national coffers was $100 billion.
A momentous opportunity exists to unseat America, said Putin. I wish you to become involved in our plans.
Of course, Mr. President, said Dominica. Is he going to mention Magnet?
I want you to work with Gorelikov on the case.
The case is the one managed by Shlikov and the GRU? Asked Dominica. The president gave her a vinegar smile and shook his head.
The case, it belongs to me, Putin said.
His cerulean halo pulsed with the unspoken ancillary thought that Dominica could read plain as day. And so do you. Gorelikov was eating lunch, waiting for her in his office, visibly apprehensive at not being invited to the private meeting between the president and Dominica. A lunch cart was beside his desk. His simmering blue halo suggested he was nervous lest Putin think he and Igorova colluded to undermine Shlikov and his operation. Mindful of the Kremlin chandeliers that hear every conversation, Dominica reassured him discreetly.
The president complimented me on a counterintelligence coup, she said knowingly.
Gorelikov's face relaxed. He pushed a plate of golden Crimean carrot fritters toward her, slathering one with yogurt sauce for her.
You heard about Major Shlikov? He asked.
Suicide in his cell? Said Dominica. Gorelikov leaned toward her, whispering,
His loyal aide, Blokin, was given the opportunity to atone for being detained by the Turks and pitched by the Americans, apparently quite a disgrace among the Spetsnaz groups.
Blokin killed him. Nate had told her about pitching Blokin in a Turkish police station. The brute must have been humiliated.
The traditional bullet behind the ear, whispered Gorelikov. We find it useful to retain some of the old traditions. Shlikov's nerves deserted him at the last minute. They stuffed a rag in his mouth to stop his screams, like Yezhov in 1940 and Beria in 53. Nothing's really changed from the charming early days of the revolution.
Loyalty for superiors runs deep in GRU, obviously, said Dominica.
Blokin is a maniac, but... With Shlikov's demise, I believe the Istanbul covert action will be forgotten. FSB Chief Bortnikov likewise is pleased. He told the president he admired the way you wrapped up the matter.
Don't thank me, thank the Americans, she thought.
Another carrot fritter, said Gorelikov, holding it out to her, like feeding time at the petting zoo.
Executions in basements and yogurt-smothered carrot fritters. Today's Russia. Gorelikov picked up a file folder.
We have spoken about this before, but I would like you to set aside a few hours to meet the new MSS representative to Moscow, 3-star General Sun Jiangwo of Chinese State Security, Gorelikov said. Reports directly to the Minister of State Security and the State Council in Beijing.
He speaks excellent English from a previous posting to London. Beijing recently initiated contact discreetly, claiming they want to improve and expand cooperation with Moscow, and the relationship between security services is a place to start.